American government, and especially subjects like Social Security, it's very appropriate that Professor Martha Derthick, distinguished political scientist in the government department, a longtime friend and servant of the Miller Center, should introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Ken. I'm Martha Derthick, professor of government and foreign affairs at UVA, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker this morning. He is a welcome, very welcome guest. He's just finished talking to my class, and with a break of 5 or 10 minutes, here he is to talk yet again, showing that he's an appropriate representative of youth, which is the role in which he appears today. He's the executive director, and I think it's fair to say principal founder of Third Millennium, which has headquarters in New York and has established itself as a representative, a spokesman for the younger generation in politics. Persons born, you said, after 1960? That's the definition of the cohort. Rich graduated from Haverford with a honors in history. He was a history major, graduated in, was it in the 1980s, 87. And had a career in journalism, but has for the last several years been active as the leader of Third Millennium. He writes frequently for newspapers. He writes op-ed pieces. He testifies in Washington. He was invited to the White House conference that the Clinton administration sponsored on Social Security at the end of last year. He's testified before the Senate Budget Committee's Social Security Task Force. So he has established himself as a spokesman for youth on Social Security. He's very interested in intergenerational issues, so we're delighted to have him here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Derthick, for that warm introduction. Actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to stand because I might find it a little bit easier to march back and forth and animate myself. That's the easiest way to keep people interested in this discussion. So, if you don't mind,
if you can't hear me, ask me to speak up. Can you all hear me?
We're taping, so try to stay as near to the machine.
I will. I will do that. I talk about Social Security in front of various audiences, in front of corporate groups, civic organizations, college audiences, just like Professor Derthick's class this morning, and another class by Professor Alexander last night. And it's interesting to see people's reaction when I talk about this issue, particularly having somebody in his 30s, as I'm 34, talking about an issue that is seemingly an issue that mostly is, you generally sense, is of most concern to senior citizens. And I look at this not, I don't look at Social Security as an old person's issue, it is an American issue, particularly the challenge we face with Social Security going forward. So when I talk about this, for those of you who are senior citizens, I ask you to look at me as one of your grandchildren. If you're middle-aged, I ask you to look at me as a younger cousin, sibling. And if you're in your 30s or 20s, think of me, again, as a sibling or a peer. And let's talk about this issue as Americans. I look at Social Security, and I think about all the wonderful things it has done in this century for senior citizens. I was just talking to Professor Derthick's class about what Social Security has accomplished. If it weren't for Social Security, half of today's senior citizens would be living in poverty, as opposed to just 10%. That is a phenomenal success record that I think no other social policy in this century can match. And that's looking at the glass being half full. Unfortunately, I'm going to spend some of my time talking about the glass being half empty and how to fill it. I look at the numbers of who receives Social Security and what Social Security does for them. Today, Social Security is the majority source of income for a majority of senior citizens. In other words, majority of seniors get the majority of their income from Social Security. 1/7 of all senior citizens get all of their income from Social Security. So it plays a vital role in the lives of tens of millions of seniors. The average Social Security benefit each month to a retired worker is $780. That's it. And a lot of today's seniors, and many of you are seniors, know that when you were young, average lifespans were far shorter than they are today. Indeed, many of today's senior citizens didn't expect to live as long as they've actually lived. We have what President Clinton describes as a good problem, which is that people are living longer. The flip side of it is that we have to pay for it. And that's what we're trying to figure out. Now, we're in the Miller Center. My sister happens to be married to a Miller herself, not the Miller of the Miller Center, but a Miller up north. And my sister just had a baby last month. Her name is Maggie J. Miller, the baby's name. My sister's name is Jill. Maggie has a 1 in 3 chance of living to 100, according to today's actuarial tables. 1 in 3 chance of living to 100. She will live to see the dawn of the 22nd century. Very likely. So she will spend 30 or 35 years as a senior citizen, as will a good number of her contemporaries. It's a future that those of you who are seniors today couldn't have imagined when you were children. And the question I have is, again, how do we pay for it? And more precisely, who is responsible for keeping Maggie and her contemporaries in a dignified retirement over the course of several decades? And what do we have to do to get from today's system to tomorrow's system? Let me talk about goals. The goal of Social Security in the 20th century was to provide a floor of protection, to lift people out of poverty. Again, it was remarkably successful. The goal for the 21st century, in my mind, is to provide dignity in retirement, to set a higher standard, a higher goal, for a larger number of people. How do we do that? Social Security is the sole source of income for, as I said, for millions of seniors. As the sole source of income, by definition, you don't have the other legs of what is traditionally described as the three-legged stool in place. You don't have company pensions, and you don't have personal savings. For most seniors, there is either no or a small pension in place, and the amount of personal savings is rather meager. So I believe what we need to do to create dignity in retirement for the 21st century is to say to every person working today, particularly young workers and future workers, you need to have at least two sources of income. The first source of income should be the floor of protection, which is Social Security. The second component should be some sort of required mandatory savings. Now, the president has come out with a plan for universal savings accounts for workers. I think the concept is extremely sound. We must have Maggie and her generation, people of my generation, who are going to live to 80, 90, or 100 and beyond, in a position where they don't have to rely exclusively on Social Security. Again, the question becomes, how do we pay for it? Now, there are some who would argue that we should take a portion of the current Social Security tax, the FICA tax, and put that in a personal account. Described in policy circles as a carve-out. In other words, you're carving a portion of the current FICA tax out, the part actually that we're not using. As you all know, we're generating huge surpluses in Social Security each year, and to set that aside in a personal account. Others argue that we should add on to the present Social Security tax and have that go into a personal account. Others yet say it should be funded by the general revenues of the government and the surplus that we create there. This is an inside-the-beltway political fight. It is happening as we speak. We're nowhere near resolution on this subject, unfortunately. But the sooner we act, the sooner we can take advantage of the fact that when you start putting money aside, and it compounds over the course of a lifetime, the more money you have when you have to rely on it. Are there any questions so far? No. Are we in agreement? Okay. This is a distinctly American problem, getting back to my opening statement. Now, there are some folks who would try to pit the generations at each other. It's the young versus the old. In my mind, this is not about the young versus the old. I think that today's senior citizens, the World War II generation, has done a remarkable job in providing for America. I think you've done an enviable job as being active in the political process. And when I was explaining to Professor Durthick's class before, and I'll repeat to you, the reason why we have the situation we have with Medicare and Social Security right now is that seniors are active in the political process, and my generation is not. And that what we need to have, actually, is a vigorous dialogue. And we don't have it yet. We don't have it because young people don't, for the most part, don't get this. Professor Durthick's students do because they're in her class. They're very lucky to understand these challenges. These challenges of aging and demographics. But most of them don't. So what happens is that politicians, faced by mostly seniors who keep them in power, are doing what they can to perpetuate the current Social Security system, are unwilling to change it, and enable it to grow and expand and account for the demographic changes that we're going to face. I am not blaming senior citizens. You are doing what you should be doing. You're voting, and you're engaged in the political system, and you're looking to do what you think is in the best interest of your generation and those that follow. But to truly fix Social Security, I believe we have to have an engaged political discussion. In the last election, last November, 60% of senior citizens voted. Less than 20% of people 18 to 24 voted. Members of Congress look at senior citizens and say, we have to rely on you almost exclusively for our votes. Which means that, and I'm not saying this in any sort of accusatory fashion, means that the interests of the seniors are prevailing. The question is that necessarily the optimal policy for Maggie, my niece? And can we create a system whereby everybody's participating, everybody's looking out for the future, and together, cobbling together a policy that works for the 21st century? And that's the key question that we have right now. Now, I was posing to Professor Durthick's class the proposition that things are going to be very difficult, because you have 77 million baby boomers who are all going to be 65 or older by the year 2030. There is no national plan right now to accommodate their needs in terms of pension and in terms of health benefits. We are literally going to bust the bank in providing benefits to that generation. If we don't prepare now, as I said to her class, payroll taxes are going to increase substantially. Right now, they are the highest in American history. Workers today, if they earn the maximum cutoff on Social Security, $72,600 a year, the threshold amount, will pay over $10,000 a year in FICA taxes, $8,000 or so for Social Security and the rest for Medicare. That's a lot of tax. And I said to them, if we do nothing, we don't change the system at all, we're going to wind up with FICA taxes of not $8,000 or $9,000 a year, but $12,000 or $13,000 or $14,000 a year levied on people with those incomes. Even worse, the people who make $30,000 or $20,000 a year are going to see huge increases in their tax, people who can't afford to have their taxes increased. Or conversely, we can cut benefits. Now, we talked about this in your class as well. What happens if we cut benefits to today's senior citizens? Let me ask you this, those of you who are on Social Security. If your benefits were to be cut by 27% in your next check, how many of you would be inclined to march up to Washington, talk to your congressman, and say, this is intolerable? A number of you would be very, very upset if that were to happen. According to the best projections we have today, that's supposed to happen to me when I am your age. In the year 2034, I'll be 69 years old. And the government is saying, according to its current best projections, according to the trustees of the Social Security and Medicare system, that the government will only be able to pay me 73% of the benefits it's now promising. So we are now over a generation away from knowing that we have a crisis on our hands. That's a good problem. If we had known in 1925 that we had to fight World War II, would we have been better prepared? If we had known in 1915 that we were going to face the Great Depression, would we have been better prepared? Very likely we would have been better prepared. Well, this is the chance now to be better prepared, to make the necessary changes in these programs so that they work. This is not an impossible problem to surmount. Now, let me make you feel a little bit better about the problem, because I made you feel bad. I'll make you feel better by pointing to the fact that, yes, we are Americans, and this problem is severe. But you know what? It's a lot more difficult and a lot more severe abroad. Yesterday, I was in Washington, and I heard a presentation by Pete Peterson, the former Secretary of Commerce. He's the founder of the Concord Coalition, a group I'm sure you've heard of. And he just came out with a new book called Gray Dawn. I don't know if you've seen this book. It's gotten some very good reviews. And he talks about the aging of the industrialized world. Now, let me throw a couple of figures out to you. Bear with me. Most or all of you have probably been to Florida at some point in your lives. Right now, roughly one-fifth of the population of Florida is 65 or older. Actually, it's 18.5%. The entire United States will have a demographic profile like Florida's in about 24 years. Okay? So the whole country will look the way Florida does today in about a quarter century. How many of you have been to Italy? Italy will look like Florida in 4 years. Japan will look like Florida in 6. Germany will look like Florida in 7 years. England in 17 years, France in 17 years, Canada in 22 years. This is not a distinctly American problem. Peterson mentioned yesterday that years ago, he remembered the TV show, The $64 Question. Then years later, in the 70s, we had a TV show called The $64,000 Question. What he posed yesterday was a $64 trillion question. How do we pay for the aging populations in the industrialized world for whom we have not accounted for the dollars we have to pay them in the future? We have a $64 trillion unfunded liability across the industrialized world. Huge promises made to the baby boom generation globally, and no real plan to accommodate for it. Now, there are ways to pay for it, of course. You can cut benefits. That's not a popular idea. You can raise taxes. That's not a popular idea. You can print money. That's not a popular idea. Those of you who remember what happened to Germany after World War I knows exactly what happens when you print money willy-nilly. The question that we have is, how do we accommodate for this aging population? And I would argue they take some tough steps. Let me just outline them for you. One is you raise the retirement age, or eligibility age for Social Security. Not for people who are now retired, for people who are now 40 and younger. You say to them, look, when Social Security was started, the average lifespan was 61. It's now 76. Little Maggie is going to live to 100. Is it fair to say to her you have to work a few more years to collect your benefits? I think it's fair. Is this a popular idea if you poll people across the country? Absolutely not. They hate this idea. Who wants to work longer, especially in a job that you might not like? The fact of the matter is, in my mind, we've given people an added 15 years of life, just in the lifespans of many of you sitting around this table. And with that added lifespan comes an added responsibility to work. Now the question becomes, how do you get from here to there? Companies have been laying people off in their early and mid-50s. That's one of the key challenges we face. Transitioning from a system where people retire at 50, 55, and 60 to one where they work until 70 and maybe not hold the same jobs that they held during most of their working lives. Keep in mind, for today's baby boomers, and I'm Generation Xer, the work profile has changed considerably. I'm going to change jobs 8 or 10 times in my lifetime. That's common. So can we keep people changing jobs, entering new careers, finding new challenges over the course of a lifetime, so that they will want to stay in the workforce? The other issue is, I had a very interesting experience about 3 years ago. I got to make a presentation to a company called Quasha Lipton. They are an employee benefits consulting firm in Fort Lee, New Jersey. Actually, they're now owned by Price Waterhouse, one of the big accounting firms. And I stood up and I used the phrase, when the baby boomers retire, ... And one guy shot out of his seat and he turned to me and said, what makes you think the baby boomers are going to be able to retire? And they went on to say that boomers have not saved enough to retire, that work, that employers are going to be desperate for highly qualified, experienced employees because the generation following is so much smaller, my generation. They're going to need baby boomers to stay in the workforce, that we're going to have labor shortages going into the 21st century, and that the whole idea of working longer is going to shift. Right now, about half the senior citizens take Social Security at 62 as opposed to 65. That phenomenon is going to have to shift back. Is it going to be fun? Are people going to like it? No. Most people don't know that the retirement age is already scheduled to rise to 67. By the year 2027, when I'm 62, the normal retirement age is going to rise to 67. When did that happen? 16 years ago. That was a result of the Greenspan Commission and the legislation that President Reagan signed. So we've already gone part of the way toward increasing the retirement age. We have to do it sooner. We have to do it more aggressively, and we have to give people time to prepare. But somebody who's now 35 or 40, if you said you have to work to 70 instead of 67, they'll say, okay, I don't like it, I'm not excited about it. If I can make enough money, I'll retire on my own and not collect Social Security until 70. But I think that's a reasonable request to make. Second thing we need to do is we need to fix the consumer price index. The government right now, according to Senator Moynihan, good friend of Professor Derthick's, a man I greatly respect as well, says we have a flaw at the heart of our calculations, that we are giving benefits each month that are just slightly higher than they should be. If you fix the consumer price index, which is the way you calculate the COLAs, the cost of living adjustments that retirees get, if you just make a modest adjustment and have it accurately reflect inflation as opposed to not accurately reflect it, you'll save $1 trillion over 12 years. Very small mistake, very big cost. The government has already fixed a portion of it, but it's not gone as far as it should. The third thing we should do is we should go back to the point I was making before about setting some money aside. We might want to say to today's workers, we have to lower our promises to you. But in exchange for that, we're going to make it easier for you to set money aside while you're working so that when you retire, there's some benefit that you'll get over and above Social Security. So that when my generation is old, you won't have 1/7 relying exclusively on Social Security. You'll have 0 relying exclusively on Social Security. They will have that, plus they will have the product of an investment that's grown over a lifetime. Now, some of you will say to me, what about the stock market crashing? Many of you have lived through the Great Depression. If you turn to a 55-year-old and said, we're going to give you money to put in the stock market, and that's going to work for you for your retirement, I say, you're dreaming. Market could crash. You have no time to recover. Historically, over any 30-year period in the history of the United States, going back to 1802, any 30-year period, the market has risen on average. So somebody who's now 34, like me, if I weather a market crash at the age of 46, I will have time to recover. If someone put money in the market in 1926 and pulled out in 1934, you bet they lost money. You remember, some of you, how much they lost. My grandparents never touched the market. My father's parents, my grandfather put all of his money in bonds. Would not go near the market. He thought it was a fool's paradise. So scared of it. And you know, entire generation of Americans were scared of the market after the Great Depression. However, he missed out on a remarkable growth in the market in the 50s, the 60s, and 70s. And when he died, he left not nearly as much money as he could have. It wasn't all that important to him because he was comfortable enough, he and my grandmother, but they lost out on a remarkable opportunity to have a tremendous return on investment. Why? Because they had a 30-year horizon and set it in stocks, they would have done better. So what I'm suggesting is you say to people like me, like my niece, We're going to set money aside, and it's going to grow over 40, 50, 60 years. On the day you retire, the market could drop by half. But you know what? You'd be better off than if you had all your money in Social Security, and all you had was your Social Security benefit. Now, by the way, I am not talking about making everybody wealthy in retirement. This is not about turning everybody into a millionaire. I think it's preposterous to think that we can promise wealth to everybody in retirement. That is a, again, foolish notion. At the margins, right now the average benefit is $780 a month. If you combine maybe a smaller promised guaranteed benefit, say $600 a month, plus the ability for a portion to grow over and above that, maybe we can give people $1,000 a month or $1,200 a month. Again, it's not about wealth. It's about dignity and security. Are younger people today willing to make that trade-off between a little bit less of a guaranteed benefit in exchange for a larger growth over the course of a working lifetime? It's not about full privatization. This is about what is considered, I guess, a partial privatization. Keep most of the social safety net in place, and then get a little bit to grow. That conceptually is what we're advocating, and to do this not only in the United States, but around the world. Indeed, some of this has been done around the world. You've heard about the Chilean system, which is a fully privatized system. We have a partially privatized system in Australia and England and other countries around the world. We are actually the laggards in creating a system of accounts for workers. And what we need to do is to begin catching up. This won't be easy. This won't be a cakewalk. But what we need to do is collectively, as Americans, say to our government, we have a demographic iceberg on the horizon. It is going to be very dangerous if we do nothing, and we must act now. So my claim and my contention, as I speak to all of you, is to ask you to join not just me, but everybody who's advocating for reform, to push for it as soon as possible. Now, if you want to ask me during question and answer session about the politics of what's going on right now, I'll be happy to do so. It's one other point. Social Security right now is 22% of the federal budget. Medicare is about 10 or 11%. In 25 years, Medicare, which is now half the size of Social Security, will be the same size as Social Security, 22%. You're talking about a huge increase in the cost of Medicare. Why? It's driven by two things. One, the demographics I've been describing, and two, the cost of health care, the costs of which are very hard to predict. Medicare could be larger than Social Security in fewer than 25 years. It could be, if we are able to keep costs down, it'll take longer. But the inexorable growth in Medicare, combined with the growth in the population of senior citizens, combined with the promises that we've made, will mean that the government in the year 2030 will take every cent of revenue and spend it on four things: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and federal pensions. That's it. Everything else that you think of as government will have to be borrowed or not spent at all. No national defense, no park service, no inoculation for poor children, no education, all the departments of the cabinet you're thinking of, no money for them. Everything that you think of as government will not be able to be funded because we will have all of our promises tied up in entitlement programs. So if you're a liberal and you think that you want to have the government do other things than provide Social Security and Medicare benefits, we have to act now. If you're a conservative who thinks we have to have a strong national defense and we have to pay for it somehow, we have to act now. This is not about liberals and conservatives. It's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's about, as Americans, confronting the fact that we've been successful. We won. We are keeping people alive longer. This is great news. But there's a cost attached. Thank you.
Begin the discussion. Mrs. Yerke.
There's been talk about putting a portion of Social Security on the stock market. Wouldn't you stand a chance of losing it? The stock market can come down.
The stock market can come down. That was part of my point. There are a lot of fights going on in Washington. I mean, that's why we have Washington, so people can fight with each other and not do it with guns. They can do it with words. And what they're fighting about in Washington, one big fight, is whether the government should take all of the surplus Social Security dollars and collectively invest it on behalf of all of us. Now, people on the other side, myself included, say it should be in the form of an individual account. Some would say, well, if you collectivize it and the market drops too much, that the government can always create from somehow a cash infusion and make up the difference. And that if it fluctuates, you're able to eliminate the individual differences in benefit. In other words, let's say you have twin sisters who had the same job their entire lives, same income their entire lives. They decide to retire a month apart. And the stock market isn't the same on the day they retire and they create an annuity. And the second sister gets $50 a month less than the other sister. Because they have this account that they decided to cash in at a different point. With the system, with the government doing all the investing, it wouldn't make a difference. Because we've just defined what the benefit was going to be, as we do right now with Social Security. And it wouldn't have made any difference. The same income, same working history, they would get the same benefit. Individual account system, yes, there would be some sort of discrepancy. And the question is, as a society, do we want that? Is that okay to have that type of discrepancy? I would say yes. Let me explain why. I'm concerned about the government doing the investing for all of us for a couple of reasons. The most common reason you hear opposed to it is not the reason I find most objectionable, but I'll throw it out anyway. There are a lot of people who say it's sort of a backdoor form of socialism. The government buys stocks, owns a portion of the stock market. It's going to start making investment decisions. It's going to start picking winners and losers. And it's going to start owning corporate America. We have a case right now against Microsoft. Right now we're suing Microsoft. In the future, will we buy Microsoft in order to win the case? It's an argument that you hear. I think it has some merit. My greater concern is about the politicization of that process. And it has nothing to do with party identification. You have a company, for example, that says, we're going to ship some of our workers down to Mexico. We want to have lower wage workers. We want to save money on labor costs. So Dick Gephardt stands up and says, well, that company shouldn't be getting some of our Social Security money. Let's take them out of the index. Then Jesse Helms stands up and says, my God, this company is manufacturing RU486, the abortion pill. I'm opposed to abortion. Why are our Social Security dollars going into that company? And suddenly all 535 members of Congress, each with their own pet cause, decides to make it a political issue, and we spend all of our time deciding what exceptions to make. Now, there are various attempts to insulate this from politics. When you're talking about the sum of money we're talking about, hundreds of billions of dollars, I think it is impossible to really isolate it, insulate it from politics, because there will always be those egregious cases. You have a company where the top five executives of the company stole huge amounts of money, and there's a huge outcry. Another example, and one I used actually last night when I spoke to Professor Alexander's class, the Exxon Valdez. Say it crashes in Alaska again. We have 11 million gallons of oil poured into the sound. Environmentalists go crazy. It didn't happen once, it happened twice. And this time, my Social Security money helped pay for Exxon to ruin the environment. Every environmental group would go crazy, and I believe justifiably so, and say we should make an exception. And that's where I have the difficulty with this, because members of Congress will give in to that pressure. And if you don't believe me, I was listening to a member of Congress describe how he would be willing to give in to pressure like this if it were created. If it's in the individual's possession, it's in your possession, and you don't like what Exxon did, move your money out of the account that has Exxon stock in it. So you as an individual, and you can get all your friends to do it as well, create a grassroots movement to get your money out of Exxon. But don't force that decision on everybody. The other part of this, of course, is that if we collectivize that investment, there are a lot of Americans who don't want to be in the stock market. You're forcing them into it by collectivizing it. Some portion of their money is going to be there. Is it perfect in either situation? Absolutely not. The individual accounts process, I'll give you a major objection to what I believe. You have to create 144 million accounts. Do you know how much time and energy is invested in that? Some portion of the value of that account has to go to maintaining it. We haven't figured out precisely how much that cost is and whether it's affordable for low and middle income workers. Huge issues surrounding this. But I always come back to, what if we don't do that? And if we don't do that, we consign people of my age group, low wage, to a lower income than they would have had if they had invested. Again, it's all about trade-offs. That's a long answer to your question, but it's a very important point about who should be doing that investing and how it's structured. These are tough issues.
Yes.
Why do you think that the federal thrift savings plan as a model for individual savings account?
I actually like it.
Pardon?
I do like it.
You do?
I like it. Now, let me explain to people in this audience who are not familiar with it, what it is. The federal thrift savings plan is a plan that federal workers have for their pensions. Basically, the government provides a small base pension, and then above that, employers have their contributions matched. And then they can add over and above that and apportion themselves. They have had, until recently, three investment choices: a stock index fund, a corporate bond fund, or a government bond fund. I believe they're adding an international fund as well. It's a narrow range of choices. It requires no particular financial expertise to invest. You don't have to read the financial pages of Investor's Business Daily to benefit from this. And has the benefits of simplicity for both the employee and the employer. And federal employees, by the way, many of them really like it. And the idea is to take that model and convert it to a portion of the Social Security FICA tax that people are paying, or even possibly doing it as an add-on. That's still part of that debate. But I like that model. I think it's preposterous to say to people who've never invested before in their lives, here's a copy of the Wall Street Journal, pick a mutual fund that you like, and take your chances. That is the recipe for unmitigated disaster. I know people who make $100,000 a year who don't even know the difference between a stock and a bond. It's not about wealth or intelligence, it's about experience and willingness to learn and discipline in investing. Some people have it, some people don't. I don't want to spend all that time and energy trying to educate everybody about the inner workings of the markets. I want them to have financial security. How do you do it with a system like the Federal Thrift Savings Plan? Does it have to be exactly that plan? No. But if you do it as a complement to Social Security, I think it can really, really work. You don't get around the problem I was just describing with the creation of those accounts. You still have to do it. There are only two entities in the United States that have 144 million accounts in it. One is the IRS and one is the Social Security Administration. So you have to either work with either of those entities to create this system or create a new one side by side. Anyone who tells you this can be done quickly or inexpensively is lying. This will take years and it will take a lot of money to do. And you have all sorts of issues around, well, what do you do if somebody gets divorced? What kind of benefits are attributed to the spouse? I mean, there are a lot of all sorts of very knotty problems surrounding this. But at the end of the day, I think those are surmountable if they're well thought out. And based upon that model. In fact, there's an organization in Washington called the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where I heard Peterson speak yesterday. And they have a commission, actually, I have a copy of their report, called the 21st Century Retirement Security Plan, in which they embrace a federal thrift savings plan model for reform. Bipartisan plan put out by Senator John Breaux of Louisiana and Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. I think that's where the model is. Simple, streamlined, with a good chance of long-term positive returns. That's what we're looking at. So I'm really glad you asked about that.
Victor, you consideration the inflation that's inherent in the economy in your projections?
Yes. Yes. And, I mean, if you take into account the, in terms of what, in terms of the value of a stock over time? Is
the value of the dollar. How it's depreciated over generations.
That is presumed in all the calculations that I've provided to you. I mean, the stock market, for example, has grown 7% in real terms historically over the 20th century. Bonds have grown 4% historically over the history of the 20th century. So the best hedge against inflation has been the stock market over the course of the 20th century.
No, but can you project the rate of inflation?
Can you project it's impossible to project the exact rate of inflation. I mean, whatever assumptions that you make have to be based on historical experience. We know roughly what inflation, has been in this century on average, and we're able to bring that into the calculations. I mean, that's one thing that makes forecasting difficult, which is that we could have unprecedentedly high inflation in the next century or unprecedentedly low inflation. And that makes forecasting that much more difficult. I mean, there are things that we know well and things that we don't know well. Let me tell you what we know well. We can make a pretty good guess about what the demographics of the country will look like in 30 or 40 years. We know how many people are going to be 35 years old in 35 years. Why? Because we know how many people are going to be born this year. That's a pretty good guess. We can do fairly well with that. We also, based upon what we know about longevity, make a decent guess about how many people will be 75, 80, 85, or 90. We might be off. My guess is that if we're off, we're going to be off because we were too cautious in our guess, that people will actually, on average, live longer than we think they're going to live. Things that we don't know how large the surplus is going to be over the next 15 years. As I was saying to Professor Durthick's class, the president said we're going to have a surplus of $4.5 trillion over the next 15 years. 6 months ago, before the State of the Union address, did any of you hear about a surplus being $4.5 trillion? No. It seems to have been created from out of nowhere. It's like manna from heaven. Why, where did that come from? We've had very favorable economic times over the last several years, and it's caused the planets to be in alignment, metaphorically, and we have a terrific estimate of returns. It wasn't that long ago, when Clinton took office, that we had deficits as far as the eye could see, $200 billion plus, as far as the eye can see. We're entering, we believe, a period of surpluses after a 30-year period of deficits. But we don't know that for sure. The surpluses may never materialize. I hope they do. It would be great for us. We could do a lot of good things with it. But if we can't, or they don't materialize, what's our plan? How do we decide what to do for the aging of the population if those surpluses do not materialize? And that's the question that I'm worried about. And of course, there are other, like you asked about inflation, linked into that question as well. Sure, I'm going on a little too long in my answers, I apologize, but I hope that addressed part of your concern.
Robert Holo.
We know that the baby boom is kind of a double whammy for Social Security. Not only is there a very large group of people retiring over the next, I don't know how many years, but also they're going to live longer. Mm-hmm. Now, all of this means that, of course, it's bad news for Social Security that it will have to spend more and more and more money. My question is, at some point, the bubble will have passed, no more baby boomers retiring, and they'll start dying out, and therefore the curve will start turning down as to how much we spend. Where do you expect this to occur? When do you expect this to occur?
That's getting too long. That's actually the question you were asking me in the car, cut me over almost. It depends, I mean, not to sound too lawyerly, it depends on how long the boomers live on average.
That's which right. But you said we can predict that pretty well.
You can predict fairly well how long, I mean, if you predict that people are going to live, let me throw a couple numbers out right now and we can project a little bit further out. A man turning 65 this year has a 50-50 chance of living to 80. A woman turning 65 this year has a 50-50 chance of living to 84. How many years do you want to add to that for the baby boomers who are not that far behind? 1-2 years maybe on average? Those are the types of estimates that you're going to have about when that turns. I mean, you have to look at the peak years of the baby boom, which are in the mid-50s, and project out lifespans from that point forward. I can't do that arithmetic in my head, but you can tell it's going to be sometime in the mid part of early to mid part of the second quarter of the 21st century. Now, the issue, of course, you face is that we don't know what's going to happen with biotechnology. We might wind up finding that people my age, because they benefit from biotechnology in a way we never guessed, might live on average to 110. In which case, you don't have a boom with us, there aren't a lot of us, but we're living a pretty long time, which negates the fact that we're a smaller generation. So the costs, again, are great for the generations that follow. We have what's called an echo boom, which are the children of the baby boom, which is also very large in size. And what does it mean to have these compressed generations that are very large in number, then smaller generations, and larger than smaller? Are we sort of consigned by the fate of history to be between alternative trends of boom and bust? I mean, they're very big questions to ask about this, and those are very, very hard to know. But we're much better at knowing what's going to happen in terms of demographics 20, 30 years out than 50 or 75 years out. But the people who are going to be 50 years old in 2075 haven't been born yet. So those numbers we can't project.
Yes. Two questions.
Sure.
One, much has been made of the fact that when the first person retired on Social Security, there were, I think, 12 or 13 people working for each one retiring. Mm-hmm. And that in not too long a time in the future, it's going to be something like 1.9 workers or I can't remember the exact figures. How does that affect this? And my second question is, the cap now is at $72,600. which makes Social Security a totally regressive tax to pay in. What should be done, if anything, about that?
Okay, two excellent questions. First was on the ratio of workers to retirees. That has a huge impact on it. Right now it's 3.3 workers for every retiree, supporting every retiree. By the time the boomers are in full retirement, all past 65, it'll be 2-1. It means that, sort of what it's implicit in, is that you're going to have to either cut benefits to those who are retired, increase taxes considerably for the people who are still working, or if we're prudent, as I'm suggesting, we actually take some steps now to pre-fund some of those costs. That's what happens when you have a large number of people all going to retire in roughly the same period. As for the regressivity of the Social Security tax, there's a movement afoot among liberals to eliminate the cap. Let me explain sort of how this works and what the concept is behind it, because it's actually a very interesting idea. I don't necessarily agree with it in its entirety, but it's an interesting idea. The argument works as follows. Social Security is basically a flat tax up until $72,600. You pay the same 12.4% of your income, no matter how much you make, up until $72,600. Past $72,600, you're home free. You don't pay any Social Security tax. One example, Maggie's father, my brother-in-law. He's an attorney in New York. He makes a very, very good salary. At some point each summer, he stops paying a FICA tax. He's done. He's reached 72.6, whenever it is, May, June, July. I don't know when exactly. He hasn't shared that with me. But he's done. Meanwhile, the guy who's digging ditches in the backyard or changing bedpans in the hospital, myself included in this because I make less than 72.6, pays FICA tax from January to not stop paying it. There are a couple of parts of this. The first part is that threshold of 72.6 goes up each year with the growth in wages in the United States. Only 5 years ago, that threshold was $61,200. It's gone up by over $11,000 in just 5 years. It's a huge increase in the number of people who are covered and in the size of the tax. The second thing is there is a way to calculate what percentage of the population falls under that 72.6 threshold. And there's a move afoot to keep that constant at about 90%, which would mean that you'd raise that number of 72.6 a lot more aggressively. You'd bring it up into about the $80,000 or $90,000 range. In fact, Senator Moynihan's plan includes a concept of bringing it up to, I think, $92,000 or $93,000 a year. And say you pay the FICA tax up to $93,000, then you stop paying. Now, it's a very simple question you probably ask, which is why have a cap at all? Why not have somebody who makes $1 million a year pay the same percentage of his income or her income as somebody who makes $30,000 a year? And here's the reason. There's a link between what you pay into Social Security and what you get back in benefits. And somebody who pays in the maximum amount will get back, when he or she is retired, in theory, some reasonable return on his and her contribution. There'll be some discernible link. It'll be more money than a poor person gets back, but not a massive sum of money. If somebody earns $1 million a year and they pay $124,000 in FICA tax, when they get old, they're going to say, "You're giving me this in return?" You completely disconnect the link between contributions and benefits. And in effect, you lose the support of America's wealthy in the system. The whole part of the concept of this Social Security system was that it wouldn't be like welfare, that you only give it to the poor, that wealthy folks would get Social Security just like lower middle class and middle class and poor people would, and that you want them to be part of the system. And the way you make them feel part of the system is by giving them a reasonable return on what they contribute. So by taking the cap off altogether, you disconnect the contribution and the benefit. Now, one thing that has happened is that in 1993, we eliminated the link between contributions and benefits on Medicare. There is no cap. So if you make $1 million a year and you're self-employed, you'll pay $29,000 a year in Medicare Part A taxes. That cap is gone. But the difference is that Medicare benefits are not predicated on what you contribute. If you're healthy and you never go to the doctor, you get no Medicare benefits. If you're sick, you get the Medicare benefits ostensibly that you need. So people don't feel that psychological link between what they paid and what they get back with Medicare Part A. But they certainly, as hell, feel the difference with Social Security. If you speak to my parents, who are 64 and 62, I talk to them about means testing, which hasn't come up yet. If I talk about means testing Medicare, fine. They're okay with Leona Helmsley paying more for her Medicare premiums. But when I start talking to them about means testing Social Security, I might as well walk out of the house and not come back. And that's where our challenge is. Because it's a psychological difference. I mean, we're paying for the benefits, we're paying the taxes, we're getting the benefits. One is health, one is pension, but there's a vast difference in the way people perceive those two programs. So I noticed, again, a long answer, but I hope it gives you a sense of the nuances of this discussion, that it's not as simple as it might seem. You know, shoot the cap off and everything's going to be fine. Yes, you will raise more taxes. You will be able to prop the system up longer. All those things will happen. But at what cost? And then the wealthy people of my generation turn to my children and say, well, you know, I paid $20 million in FICA taxes. Where's my return? And or do they, in turn, bail out of the system, say, just privatize the whole thing, and lose the support of the entire wealthy class, which in turn would make Social Security welfare? And that's the danger of getting rid of the cap altogether.
I suppose it could be argued that the fact that Social Security, as you said in the beginning, has kept so many seniors out of poverty, that that very fact in itself has contributed to the wealth of the people who do not pay above 72.6.
Mm-hmm. It has.
And that, therefore, there's a return of sorts that they are getting.
Yes, there is a return of sorts. The question is making that case and how well that case can be made to those folks.
Mr. Arthur?
It seems to me there's one solution to the so-called Social Security problem, which I never hear discussed. If we were to raise our immigration on skilled employees.
Okay.
20 years, some reasonably large number, you could fill in this void you've been talking about.
This is a topic that came up in Professor Durthick's class also, and I got some hackles from the class, because I talked about things that are likely to happen and things that are unlikely to happen. I classify what you described as unlikely to happen in the numbers that you need to make it work, for two reasons. One is that we are now at the not necessarily the end of, but we have experienced a very large wave of immigration over the last 30-plus years. And there are a lot of folks who think that that wave of immigration actually should come to an end. That immigration, has come in waves. We've had periods of great immigration and periods of not closed borders, but pretty close, and then large waves of immigration again. And if you look at the historical trend, we should be actually at the point now where we're transitioning from large immigration numbers to smaller ones. And I think there's some reasonable argument for that, and I don't want to get into a whole argument about immigration, but that is where we are in terms of historical trends. Second thing is, can we or should we use immigration as a policy toward senior citizens? Is that wise? Is the best reason to bring immigrants to the United States to prop up the baby boomers in their retirement? And do you create other problems in association with that, such as Americanizing immigrants in massive numbers over a short period of time in order to pay for the baby boomers? Another problem you face is that those immigrants have a clear claim on Social Security themselves. And do you not create a problem 30 or 40 years down the road when you have a large population, again, of senior citizens? Do you create an infinite demand for new immigrants larger than the generation before, generation after generation, in order to keep the Social Security system going?
Yeah, but it does more than that. It also keeps your workforce stable. If it goes down, you may have a recession.
It does. The question also is, if you have another thing that happens, of course, is that if you have this wave of immigration and then you have a recession, what do you do with the immigrants? Did you send them back? They don't, you know, we've brought them here to ostensibly solve a problem. If the unintended consequences that we wind up with a recession and too many immigrants, we're stuck with another problem yet. I don't see it as a solution to this problem. And that's, will they contribute in some way? Yes. but I don't think to the numbers and the projections I've seen, really in huge numbers of immigrants. I mean, if you're talking about the ratio of workers to retirees going from 3-to-1 down to 2-to-1, and basically what does it say? You have to add 1/3 more workers. No, actually, well, 1.5 more workers, from 1.5, 2-to-1 to 3-to-1. Tens of millions of people just to make this work. And I don't see it working. I mean, it's a logical idea. I mean, you're not off in terms of the presumption of what, if it's a people problem, just get more people, right? The issue is the societal ones that surround it, which I don't think we've ironed out yet.
We have time for one more question. Charlie Smith.
I got a couple of pieces of bad news about Social Security over the last couple of weeks. One, Dr. Kevorkian, who's been doing his share to use the role, is in jail. And my oldest child informed me that she's now 50 and eligible for the AARP. This PAC has grown so huge and become such a menacing factor in Social Security. That's rather scary. Then I also read you talked about printing money as not being a very viable solution. Several weeks ago in the New York Times, Herbert Stein made the suggestion that why don't we just go ahead and print up a couple of $1 trillion and fund it with Treasury notes? And why not go ahead, as far as the Greenspan's concerned, let him handle all these investments. If necessary, print up another couple of $1 trillion so he can do that. Would you make your comments on that?
I respectfully disagree with Herb Stein, although he has made, actually, some of the greatest comments about Social Security. He has said that when something is unsustainable, it tends to stop, which is, I think, one of the best quips about Social Security, that it is unsustainable and that we will face a problem if we don't fix it. I just don't think printing money is the solution to the problem. Who knows what the ramifications of that would be? It's unsound fiscal policy, monetary policy. About the AARP, if you're member, let me make, since I have my closing remark, I'll make my one pitch, okay? AARP is the most powerful lobbying group in the United States. Fortune magazine described Horace Dietz, the head of AARP, as the second most powerful man in America, and I took umbrage with that remark. And let me explain why. He is the most powerful man in America because he tells Bill Clinton what he can and cannot do with Social Security. He sets the tone in running that organization. As members of AARP, those of you who are, you must tell AARP that it's in the best interest of that organization to get Social Security fixed now, because the organization is predicated on one thing in terms of membership, people turning 50, and people being happy when they turn 50, and thinking that the organization is representing them. It is critical for AARP to be active in this debate and pushing for responsible Social Security reform. The folks in Washington who run AARP do not listen as well as they should to the people in the grassroots. Regret to say that, but it's true. Those of you who are members need to be active in telling them that they have to get on the bandwagon and pushing for reform. It's very hard. 1/9 of the U.S. population belongs to AARP. I describe it metaphorically as a giant tanker in a narrow harbor. And if it moves too precipitously in any one direction, it capsizes. Those of you who remember the whole debate in the late 80s about catastrophic care, AARP said we need it, and then a year later they said we don't. Congress unanimously voted for it, and a year later unanimously overturned it. There's a huge amount of power in that organization. Members of Congress bow down to AARP because they know that's where the votes are. You have the power to make sure that your kids and grandkids have the ability to enjoy a retirement that is as secure or more secure than yours. And AARP is part of the key of making that happen. So I beseech you, as someone who's not yet eligible for AARP's membership, to encourage them to become more active in getting reforms passed. Thank you. That was all right?